I'm Kirk Harnack. On This Week in Radio Tech, we engineers are telling the programmers what to do all over again. We're engineering for content. That's the show title. Let's see if we stick to that. Chris Tarr and Chris Tobin are joining me on This Week in Radio Tech next.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Radio Tech is brought to you by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is This Week in Radio Tech, episode 123, recorded April 4th, 2012. Engineering for Content. This Week in Radio Tech is brought to you by Telos Systems and the new VX Voice over IP Multi-Studio Talk Show System. On the web at telos-systems.com/VX. It's time for This Week in Radio Tech. Hi there, I'm Kirk Harnack, your host. And today, sorry for the fuzzy picture, but if you're listening, it should sound pretty good. We're broadcasting, doing the show, I am anyway, from a location on Hudson Street in Manhattan, New York City. In fact, I'm very pleasured to be a guest here at the studios of WCBS, big 880 all-news station here in New York City. And I thank Steve and Rob very much for their setting me up in the studio here to do to do my end of the show. Just across a few subway stops up is my friend Chris Tobin. He's here. Hey, Chris, how are you?
Hello, Kirk, and my best to everybody at Hudson Street. You're in good hands. You should be in great shape there. They should be taking good care of you. All should be well.
Well, it certainly is, and I forgot to mention in my little disclaimer, the views I express, of course, are mine, and I'm employed by the folks at Telos, Omnia, and Axia, who are the sponsors of this show. This show is the one where we talk about radio technology, anything from audio to RF to some IT technology that has to do with broadcasting, and my goodness, there's a lot of it nowadays in broadcasting. Chris Tobin, as I was introducing you, you are involved with on the broadcasting and manufacturing side yourself now with Musicam USA.
That's right, CCS Musicam, and the opinions are of mine and not that the company that I represent, and strictly mine. But yeah, we do IP, audio, video, codecs, and consulting, and some other goofy stuff, but it's fun, and it's all for broadcast and IPTV folks, too.
I want to find out more about that. I think last year at the NAB show, you showed us a little bit of the CCS Musicam offerings for TV.
Yes, and this year you'll get to see some really good stuff. And matter of fact, some of the participation will be live video from outside the premises of the convention center.
Oh, okay, cool. Well, also with us is an engineer who gets his hands dirty every single day. It's Chris Tarr from Muckwonago, Wisconsin. Hey, Chris.
Hello there. I am the Director of Engineering for Intercom's radio stations in Milwaukee and Madison. I'm also a writer for Radio Guide magazine. I run the website, I co-founded the website, broadcastengineering.info, and oh, so many more things.
All right. Master of the Soda Stream as well.
Absolutely.
Hey, Chris Tarr, you got several little tricycle motors around your house, right?
Tricycle motors? Sure.
Yeah. Have any of them discovered, I've got my little 18-month-old son, Michael, he's discovered Angry Birds on my iPad and hadn't got the hang of it. He always flips the bird straight into the ground.
Well, usually I'm the one flipping the bird, but then I get in trouble for that. All my kids, my youngest is almost five, and she's, every time I get home, she comes up to me and says, "Pop, can you pull out your iPad so we can play Angry Birds?" And, you know, my son is 11. He does it all the time. So, yeah, I mean, the sound of the Angry Birds wafts through my house on a daily basis. So, yes, I know exactly what you're talking about.
Oh, my goodness. Well, hey, we got several things to talk about today. Kind of a smorgasbord, although we got a few topics we're gonna jump into, delve into a bit more in depth. Hey, our show, this show number 123, is brought to you by my friends, my employer, the folks at Telos, and the Telos VX phone system. And when we get around to the commercial break, I'm going to be showing you a little bit more about... Uh-oh. I dropped
the Foley,
part of
the Foley pit.
Oh, let's see if it's...
That's why you don't get any nice things, Kirk. That's why we don't give you anything nice.
That explains a lot.
Yeah. Okay. So we'll be looking at this Telos VX thing that they use here at WCBS. Okay. Yeah. All right. Hey, Chris Tarr, I saw a Facebook posting today. You were at a transmitter site, and you had some interesting things to say about a transmitter that the manufacturer of which has not been around since I've been in radio. So I believe it just totally predates me being in radio. Not that that's horribly old. What were you dealing with today out there?
I wasn't actually working on that. I happened to take a picture of it as I was walking by. That's an AEL 25 KB transmitter. And AEL went out of business about 1979. Transmitter, I believe, was right around 1970. And the story has it that the then owner of the radio station saw it on the floor at NEB and bought it. And shortly thereafter had it shipped. And up until about a year or two ago, that was our backup transmitter there. It's been since replaced with an Autel. But I was just talking about some of the interesting features of that transmitter. For example, on the front, you don't have the normal set of buttons that you normally have. Played on, played off, filament on, off. It has three buttons. It has start, stop, and reset. And one of the features of that transmitter, it was the logic, which at the time was pretty advanced for a transmitter. You turn on the start button, which would turn on the filament and start a timer. And then the timer would, count down. And then when the timer counted out, it turned on the plates automatically. Now you could override that. There's a toggle switch inside of the cabinet you could turn that on and off with. But generally you'd leave that on and it was real easy to, to operate. Want your transmitter on? Press start. Want to stop it? Press stop. The other interesting thing about that transmitter, it is the quietest transmitter I had ever heard. I thought actually at first I thought it was liquid cooled the first time I used it because I couldn't run it. I was like, what is that thing running? I can't tell. And it's really, really quiet. So anyway, it's interesting because it actually still functions. There's a couple of things we need to fix on it, but it was served for many, many years as the main transmitter. They actually had two identical ones, these KB models. One of them then retired and was used as parts, and they put in a Continental for the main transmitter. And this one went on and on for many years as a backup transmitter. And it was just interesting because I've never seen one before. And everybody who sees it says, I don't think there's any of those left anywhere on the planet. There might be one or two, but they were a pretty rare species when they were built because they didn't manufacture them for long. They went on to the KD series, which was really what AEL was known for. Interesting. It's an interesting little transmitter. And like I said, I think now we no longer use it. I don't know what to do with it. I kind of hate to part with it, though. It's almost like having a little piece of history in your transmitter building.
So I got to work on an AEL many years ago, and not much where I just kind of cleaned it up, and it was actually working okay. I didn't have to fix anything. It was in Little Rock, Arkansas, and it was a backup transmitter. And I, too, noticed that it was a pretty quiet transmitter. I wouldn't say that you couldn't hear it working, but it may have been a different series than what you had. But here's my question. What is it about the transmitter's design that allows it to be so quiet? Because, some transmitters are just screamers. And it's hard to be in the same room with them. Typical high-power FM transmitters use a lot of forced air to blow across the tube, assuming that that's, a tube-type transmitter, FM transmitter. Some of these are designed with, actually fairly small ports and a whole lot of velocity on the air to get enough volume through the tube. Do you know why this one is quiet?
I wish I did. I don't know if maybe it's the type of fan that they used or the design of how the airflow was. But I do know that it's a very thick, heavy cabinet designed very well. I mean, the cabinetry on this transmitter is very nice. So I think it's a combination of workmanship and probably the type of blower that they use. It's just very, I would imagine it's probably not a whole lot more airflow than what was needed. And there's just a little hum to it. And that's about it. And it was actually kind of interesting. Even that the transmitter design is real interesting, and just the way that things like start and stop and how they had some of the metering done, and it's an interesting transmitter. I really it's one of those things where I love to bring other people up there because they'd stop and look at it for 10 or 20 minutes just because it's so fascinating. You don't see them like that anymore.
So I'm sorry if I was working on something else when you said, did you describe the start-stop sequence? Because that sounded a little like it could be a little dangerous, plates coming on well after you turn the thing on by themselves.
Yeah, well, that's we were talking about that. That's just the control ladder. And you can defeat that because the actual, there's a plate on and off inside of the cabinet. You can open up the front door and there's a big old metal toggle switch on and off. And, you know, in one way, it's dangerous. In some ways, I thought it was an interesting design and probably ahead of its time back then, because what was great about it is, you know, for example, when you have people trying to operate it from remote control, the instructions were, one, turn it on.
Yeah,
that was it.
Not turn on filaments and wait. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, and most transmitters nowadays, you know, like the Continentals, you can program them that if you hit plate on, it turns the filament on, warms up, and turns the plate on.
Sure, sure. But as an engineer standing in front of it, though, you know you've turned the plate on with that AEL. You got to remember, when I turn it on, in about 90 seconds, it's going to throw, you know, 8,000 volts at the tube, but not right now.
Right. Well, that's why, you know, you had to remember with those when you're going to work on them to make sure you turn that toggle switch off. And, you know, it's the toggle switch is pretty, you know, in your face. You knew it was there. So, you know, and again, I didn't say it was a great design. It was interesting and real nice for, you know, in terms of, you know, setting up remote controls and teaching people how to use it, because just you start it or you stop it, one or the other. And, you know, the stop function had another timer where it would do a cool down and that it would shut the doors off and everything and turn itself off. But it's an interesting piece of history. And the fact that it's complete and up until recently was still on the air. It says a lot for a transmitter that is probably, you know, 40, 42 years old now.
I'll bet in just a moment I'm going to ask Chris Tobin about any quiet FM transmitters he's worked on. And I'll bet you there may be one in your past that was blue and aluminum silver. But I'll ask you about that in a minute. First, I wanted to touch on, for those people listening who may be under the age of tubes, about what this thing is about a start sequence and a stop sequence. If you had a transmitter that used tubes, typically you wouldn't want to apply plate voltage at the same time as filament voltage. You'd want to turn on the filament voltage, let the tube warm up, and some tubes are not rated for simultaneous plate and filament application. Other tubes are, like in an old 5-tube AM radio. Well, you turn the knob on, you turn the switch on, and it would apply filaments and plate voltage about the same time. And as the filaments warmed up, then the tubes would begin to operate. And your radio would start playing. Well, in most transmitters, most high-power transmitters, the sequence is you turn the filaments on, and then you wait, or you're forced to wait, because there's a filament on timer. And if, by the way, if you're off the air, it seems like it's way too long. And then the filament on timer is typically anywhere from 30 seconds to 2 or 3 minutes. And then after that timer has elapsed, you can push the plate on and the plates will come on. And as Chris was alluding to, some transmitters, you can just push plate on, the filaments come on, and then after the timer happens, then the plates come on too. In the shutdown mode, it's the reverse of this. You don't want to just shut the tube completely off. You want to let the blower keep going. So you turn it off and the plates and the filaments would go off together, and then the blower would continue blowing for a while to cool the tube on down. But this is a normal sequence. Now, if you've just worked in radio since we've had solid-state transmitters, they're pretty much just on-off, and there's no warm-up sequence to those things, at least none that I can think of. So Chris Tobin, I remember one of the quietest transmitters I've ever dealt with was blue and silver. You know what I'm talking about? No audio from Chris Tobin.
Sorry about that. The dog was making some noise. Yes, it happens from time to time. Animals do their crazy things, just like kids. I think that was Art Linkletter's line, right?
yeah.
Sorry. Since we're talking outdated equipment and tubes and things, I just thought I'd throw that back there for TV. Well, let's see, blue and silver, I'm trying to think. The transmitters I had that were blue and white were the FM-25s and FM-5Ks.
BE.
BE is the, I was just going to say, yeah, the other quiet one was the BE-35 that I played with. No, was it BE-35? Yeah, that was
okay. 35. And actually, I was thinking of the RCAs. I was thinking they were blue and
RCAs
the
silver. RCAs that I remember, they were blue and silver. Yeah, that's right. We had an RCA at Empire. That was a noisy box.
Really?
Huh. Yeah, for some reason, it was noisy. The other one I had at another station was not noisy, so I'm not sure why that was. Harris made some nice quiet transmitters, too.
Really? Okay. I guess I didn't get to enjoy those.
the HT series, like the HT30, or I have an HT20, and it's pretty quiet, the blower on.
Really? Oh, the HT series, okay. Yeah. No. I'm just being fun, saying those of us in who have been around have worked with any of the FM25 series, maybe? FM25K?
Oh, yeah, 25K. Yeah. I love tuning up the 25K because you get just outside of the comfort zone, and wham, it sounds like an M80 going off when you're tuning it. That's,
yes.
I don't tell people that's common, you know. If you want to go with the opposite with loud transmitters, how about the jet engine? You know, get an Armstrong.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Not only is it loud, but it'll transmit into a dead short.
Well, and, you know, some plants are so bad, you kind of need that, actually.
There you go.
You know, I actually had a friend of mine called me up once in a panic. He had a site up on top of a hill, and very bad winter, very dry, a lot of electrical activity, static discharge off the towers. And their FM antenna took a hit, a discharge. It wasn't a direct hit. And it was enough to short out one of the elements. And pretty much, as far as the transmitter was concerned, it was not seeing a true load. It was almost like a dead short. But it was an Armstrong. He still had a signal. It was very poor. Got to the transmitter site. Vizwar was, well, let's just say, where it shouldn't be regardless. It was you could still hear the station somewhat in the city proper. It was the funniest thing. He said this transmitter just kept going. He tried to go to his backup, which was a two-base non-grounded grid, and we can get at that shortly. And that transmitter didn't even get up to a third power and just dumped. You know, it wouldn't even go online. He went back to the other one.
Oh, man. So, yeah. Oh.
Yeah, you have some that are noisy, some that are quiet, and some that just work no matter what.
You know, in working on transmitters, I always feel better around transmitters that aren't just making up just a pot full of noise. Maybe it's just the fact that you can think better in a room where you don't have something that sounds like a jet engine going on. But you're right. That was an objection of mine, I guess, a lack of comfort around some transmitters. And I guess the Energionics brand was fairly noisy. And so it seems like some CCA transmitters were pretty noisy. Maybe that was due to the blower being used, or just the design of how the airflow moved. I thought that the RCAs I worked on were pretty quiet, and this is kind of where I wanted to go with the conversation, because they spent a lot of time making sure the fit and finish of the doors was good. And on the inside of the doors, at least the ones I worked on, there was this sound dampening foam, this black foam that I'm sure over time, crumbled and dried out and got old. But it just seems like they went to a lot of effort to make sure that the air flowed smoothly and loud blower sounds and airflow sounds didn't escape into the room.
Yeah, I would agree with that, because I had a BE. I had BE transmitters. I had the proper, door design, and they were very quiet. They worked very well. I actually talked to a guy. I remember when this was back in the FMX days. He was a former RCA engineer out of Camden, New Jersey. Worked on many FM and I think TV transmitters. And he had told me that his joke, he went into consulting and doing many things after he left RCA. He said he found that the more noise the transmitter made, the less care into design and something else he called it was put into the box. And I thought about it. And now I look back, I go, I think there's something to be said for that. Because the boxes that were quieter than what I've worked on definitely were easier to maintain, seemed to be somewhat trouble-free, and it just seemed to match up. I'm not knocking any particular manufacturer, I'm just saying it just seems to be there's a slight pattern going on.
I wonder if they get better care because you enjoy being around them more, that you're willing to spend more time with them.
Oh, wouldn't surprise me, because, most people probably were designing equipment saying, hey, it's at a transmitter room, who goes there more than once a week, once a month, whatever, You know what? I just realized something. I bet you're right. The earlier transmitters, think about this. Prior to 1983, you had to have somebody at the transmitter site, part of your license. So I bet you RCA, who was the de facto in the day, turnkey company providing products, they were probably, and AEL and a few others, were designing equipment based on the fact that there's a transmitter person there. So why not make it so that it's easy to be around? Think about it.
Yeah, I'll bet you're right. I'll bet you're right.
Just don't know, because I'm thinking about sites I worked at.
So, Chris Tarr, did you ever have to babysit a transmitter?
Oh, sure. I mean, as part of routine you know, working on stuff. And I obviously got into this business long after that. But
obviously, yes. What was I thinking?
I have worked at radio stations where, back before, everybody bought everybody else, mom and pops for the transmitters were sitting right behind you in a glass window. And, I think there's something to what Chris is saying. I think back then, also a lot of transmitters were located inside of the building where the studio was. So I do think that, noise level was measured and accounted for in the design. I think nowadays, first of all, there's the whole price thing. And the margins are so thin that that's probably the last thing they think about. It's how much power can we put out? How much redundancy can we build in? But I don't think they care what kind of noise it makes. And honestly, I think most engineers that are buying the stuff don't even think about that anymore because they go, they get put somewhere where, you'll come in, every month or two to change the filters and that's about it.
Yeah, probably so. Okay. All right. Well, so I guess in most cases we're saying, The noise level of a transmitter is not so much a deal anymore. And, I don't know why. I guess I do know why. I just don't appreciate being around a really noisy transmitter. It's just not fun to work around. You just want to get out of the building as quickly as possible without, neatening things up and making it nice and dusting and working on it. But I think that contributes to, if it's quiet, it contributes to you wanting to be there and making sure that the site is good.
Yeah, absolutely. I would agree with you on that. I've been in many sites that were noisy. Trust me. I used to come in with my own pair of David Clark headsets that I put on, and I could just be in my own little world while I'm working in the room. It's the only way to do it at some places.
Could be a good reason to bring your Bose noise-canceling headset along with you to a noisy site.
Yeah, that too.
Yeah. Like if I'm riding in a noisy airplane. Hey, so we got the NAB show coming up. Pretty soon. It is starting parts of it are starting about a week and a half from today. What is the date that things actually get going here? I guess we're looking
15th, April 15th, Monday.
Yeah, there's some sessions going on, I believe, on Saturday and Sunday, the 14th and 15th.
Sundays,
and then,
yes.
Yeah, then the expo floor opens on the 16th, of April. Yeah. So, Chris, you had some idea. Chris Tobin, you had some ideas about things to look for at the NAB show. It's always kind of fun to speculate. Okay, what are we going to see? What's going to be improved? Will we see something new? Are broadcasters interested in things that maybe they haven't thought of yet? Are manufacturers going to be bringing things out that a broadcaster didn't know he needed until he saw it? Do you have any prognostications, Mr. Tobin?
Well, I'm curious this year to check out the site of booths that are doing anything with mobile phone technologies that integrate, schedules, music lists, and how they interact with the audience. Also, I'm definitely checking out, you have the technology pavilions. Those are always fun to check out. There's some of the stuff you see there is just like, wow, I didn't even think of that. That's where I usually start. I go to the pavilions first, walk through real quick.
I've never been to a technology pavilion, and I've certainly heard the NAB putting that word out. I've been to, I don't know how many, 20, 25 NAB shows. I've never been to a pavilion exhibit. What would we find in those?
You find a lot of stuff that sometimes is prototype material. I think one year I remember going, they're usually they do the tents outside. Some of the pavilions are inside. It depends. Every year it's different. But one of the years I went, I checked out a tech pavilion. I think it was the international one. And there were actual prototypes in plexiglass cubes. You weren't allowed to touch them. You could only look at them. Huh. Of radio receivers, portable mobile stuff. I think it was probably 2 years ago. It was pretty cool. It's actually one of them was a mobile phone that had some capability of, I think it was like early tagging for music tagging, I think was what they were trying to talk about. Maybe that was 3 or 4 years ago. But yeah, there was some wild stuff. I usually go to the pavilions first, real quick, run through, get my brain going as far as, okay, open the mind, clear the air and see what's going on. And then I poke around to various places that have something that's new coming out. From what I keep seeing, though, I'm probably going to be looking at a lot of stuff with IP-based transmitters, audio, video, remote control capabilities. Because some of the stuff I saw from Burke has some nice stuff now with their newer version, was the Arc Plus. And the guys at Automat, they have some really cool stuff coming out, too. So I'm going to check out some of that. Friends of mine have been calling up asking me about some transmitter stuff. It's like, yep, I'll check it out. But, also Nortel, I think, has something new coming out with an IP something to do with IP connectivity with their boxes, with their transmitters. So that's where I'm going to start just to begin with.
You know, it seems like last year, we walking around the show floor, we were saying, hey, this is the year that so many manufacturers are putting IP connectivity into boxes, things that previously had only been controlled by GPIO closures or by serial commands, or maybe even a bit by USB, maybe had some USB audio in and out. We're finding that more and more things have IP. And you think we're going to see even more of that this year?
I think so. Yeah. Matter of fact, I was looking at one of the NAB stats and they were talking about stuff that was, you know, moving in that direction. I think what's going to happen is you're going to see a lot more IP, because right now I still think, you know, radio's got to get their act together, but there is more happening with the mobile, I'll call it the mobile environment. Like there's no tomorrow. I mean, the use of camera phones, or, you know, cameras in phones, smartphones, or, you know, we'll call tablets, has increased. I was just reading somewhere like 84% or 200% in some markets. So think about that. If you're in radio or television, we'll just say radio for this show, and your audience is using this device and doing these things, you need to be up with that. You need to find a way to get into that realm. And the only way you're going to do it properly is going to be IP. So I'm going to look for stuff that's all IP based, or at least touch, you know, scratching the surface. And just like, you know, Chris has got his new build out for his facility, I'm sure there's some IP thinking there as far as web, I'll call it web related stuff, or the ability to reach out to the audience in more than the traditional listen on a radio top or in a car.
You know, it's kind of timely. You're mentioning what you just did about listening and web listening listening by various IP type services. In Radio World Online, there's an article, NPD, that is a company that does consumer surveys. NPD Group says 43% of web users chose to listen to music via Pandora, Slacker, Yahoo Music, etc. That doesn't mean to the exclusion of AM or FM or other sources, but it just says that they chose to listen to those sources. That's 9 percentage points higher than the previous year. At the same time, listening to music on AM and FM radio stayed relatively steady at 84% in 2011. And they say CD, now I don't get this stat, CD listening 74%. So 74%. Of respondents, I suppose, listened to a CD in 2011. I don't think I did. I don't think I listened to a CD in 2011, unless you consider a CD, you know, a ripped song from a CD to be a CD. I wouldn't. It looks like the groups that are listening most to free online radio, now they're calling it radio in this study, are going to be 18 to 25 and 26 to 35. So I guess what you might expect, 57% of those 18 to 25 and 55% of those 26 to 35. I guess we all know that online listening is growing. We know that a lot of broadcasters are trying to be involved with that, but then there's the other services that we've talked about so much, Pandora, Slacker, Yahoo Music, and other things like that. Chris Tobin, does this survey, these figures kind of jibe with what you might imagine to be true? Anything surprising here?
Yeah, no, absolutely true. There was an article today, was it today or yesterday, in the Wall Street Journal, talking about people's habits and how things have become so commonplace, where, you know, 20 years ago, some new device that comes on the market, say we'll call it the consumer electronics marketplace, somebody would look at it and go, wow, that's amazing. Today, the article I read, they talk about, teens going into an Apple store and looking at an iPad or an iPhone, and not being wowed by anything, but expecting what they found and looking for the next evolutionary step for that product.
Yeah.
You know, so think of that. If you're a radio station, okay, we're not even going to talk to the other half of the industry. We are a radio station and your audience is in that 18 to 24. And maybe it's a 24 to 35, depending on the advertisers you're choosing to chase after. And you are not in that space, okay? That space that those folks are coming and going in, say the iPad, maybe an Android tablet. What happens? What is the perception? You're out. The radio listening doesn't even happen anymore. So now when they get to the age, they're 18 to 24. Now they become the group 35 to 54, 35, 45. What's their habits going to be? You think it's going to be radio first? No. And that's where we're falling short. That's where the industry is falling short. You know, same is true in engineering. How many folks in the audience are true radio or, you know, broadcasting geeky people that if you talk to somebody about call letters, why is, call letters in California start with a K, call letters on the East Coast start with a W. Can you explain why? Most people today can't, but they're in engineering. I'm not faulting that, but that's the kind of stuff that's being lost. And I think that's where we're seeing things change. In some respects, we're not keeping up. You know, we're not self-teaching not carrying the torch, but just explaining why these things are important to understand. You don't have to live and breathe it, but just understand why they were in place at the time and why things developed and evolved as to what they are today. And that's why I think it's hurting. So that's why this year's NAB, I'm looking for stuff that's definitely out of left center, or, it's just, wow, that is just totally crazy for those of us who aren't looking to keep up with the Joneses and just say, oh, that's okay, it's a fad, I can deal with it maybe next year. And get left behind like a lot of folks are finding out.
Here's something that I thought is a little bit surprising from this survey, but I guess it jives with my own experience. Only 3% of people pay to listen to anything online, while 42% of the web radio users listen to free services. Well, I'm trying to think, do I pay for anything to listen online? And I think the answer is no. I can't think of anything that I pay for to listen online. I've got a couple of Wi-Fi radios in the house. And sure, I hear listen to free channels, and I hear the ads saying, "Hey, if you'd like to hear this commercial free, go to this website and pay us some money." I guess 3% maybe isn't surprising. Should I be surprised that it is 3%, or it's as low as 3%? Will people pay in the future to listen to stuff online? Chris Tarr, you got any idea about that? You pay for anything online?
See, yeah, and that, I think that's the rub. I think that is, I still laugh when I have people come to me and say, yeah, radio is an old technology. It's dead. And streaming's taking over and Pandora's going to kill you. And, yeah, they said that about satellite radio, too. I mean, here's the bottom line. People are just not going to pay. They aren't. Some will pay. I mean, you'll get some people, but generally they're not going to. And so that's number one. Number two is if the people who are providing the service can't monetize it, they don't do a very good job with it, and so on and so forth, and it gets to be this spiral. And I like to call it the Radio Disney effect. Radio Disney has these radio stations where they play their programming. It's pretty much commercial free. Why is that? Because it plugs everything Disney. It's just basically a promotional vehicle for Disney. And the smart radio stations, that's where it's headed. Is their radio station is just another vehicle for everything else they're doing. A great example is the CHR station, the top 40 station that we have here. 18 to 34, I mean, we just have dominating numbers here. I mean, it's just crazy. Cumin and time spent listening. But the radio is just one arm of that. We have a guy whose sole job is video production. We're constantly uploading new video content, artist interviews, live performances, that sort of thing. We have a custom, not just an iPhone app that just does, streams our station. There's actually interactive content on that. We're working on a pop-up radio thing that, shows, when you're listening to a song, shows pop-up content about the artist or the song that you're listening to. We went and got, not a generic texting number, but a custom texting number with our frequency in it. So as opposed to text the station at, as part of a bigger nationwide service, we have our very own 5-digit SMS code. So, you take all of those things and you do it right. And we don't have to charge people for our content. Yeah, they're going to have to listen to some commercials, but it's all free and it will remain that way. And companies like Pandora, they're starting with ads. And there was a great story I posted on the Twert page on Facebook about how upset people are that they're now, ads popping up on Pandora. Well, guess what? They've got to make money. There's some great articles about Spotify and the Pandoras of the world, how, has become more popular, the price to license the stuff, to do the royalties is getting to be crushing to them. And so it's going to be more and more difficult for them to do it. So, again, I think that everything, it all has its place. I think that, because honestly, I do. I listen to Pandora every now and then. I listen to satellite radio every now and then. I listen to my iPod now, or my iPod now and then. But I still come back to radio. And, you know, believe me, it's sometimes it's hard for me because it's just like working at McDonald's. You work at McDonald's, a lot of times you don't want to eat there. So, you know, I wouldn't say I listen to the radio because I work in it. I listen to the radio because I enjoy the discovery. I enjoy finding out what's going on locally, and I enjoy the personalities. So I think everything's going to have its place.
Well, Chris, with your station, the CHR, the Top 40, that's doing very well. Would you say that the on-the-air, the FM signal, the jocks talk to the audience or communicate with the audience? Would you say that there's interaction, or if you're a listener, you feel there's a connection?
You do, absolutely. Right? If you text the station, it comes into the control room and they reply right away. They've got Facebook open. They've got, you know, sometimes we kind of yell because sometimes, you know, they screw up on the air because they're paying attention to all the social networking stuff. But yeah, I mean, if you text the station, 90% of the time, whoever's on the air reply back to you. It's not, okay. You know, it's all completely real time.
So basically what you're saying is by being a local radio station and feeding the audience locally and making sure you're connecting with the audience in that manner, you are succeeding monetizing your various mediums and things are working. So
what
it's sort
concept,
of like,
right?
Right. That's what I'm saying. So I'm saying, wow. So that would be akin to maybe let's do something really retro, like 1950s, the swap hops, the doo-wops, the soda shops, drive-throughs, you pull up the car, people gather around that little speaker, listen to some guy talking to them from somewhere afar. They think they know where he's at. Or maybe we fast forward a little bit and, you know, the same thing is happening to more modern day stuff. Or maybe you're a Howard Stern listener and you decide he's no longer on terrestrial, but you still want him. You'll pay for it, but you only pay for his show because everything else you could get, it's not worth listening to. So what you're saying is if you're local and serve the audience properly or brand yourself to meet your the customer's needs, you'll be successful.
Right. And it kind of goes back. It's the Steve Jobs theory sometimes where, you know, you may think what you know what you want, but sometimes you don't. And I think a lot of people think that a Pandora or a satellite radio is great because that's really what people want is the music. But on the other hand, you put them in front of a compelling, engaging show with talent. And they won't walk away. They'll sit in their car and listen for the next break. I mean, that, you know, it's old school radio. And I think you know, I would be really worried as a broadcaster if that's what Pandora was doing. If Pandora was putting talent on there along with this music and creating a custom format with really engaging personalities, I'd be scared then. Right now, they're a jukebox. And, you know, guess what? There's about a million different jukeboxes out there.
Well, if you're going to say or akin Pandora to jukebox, then if you went to a diner in the day in order to hear the music that was in that little flip page, a little rectangular slots that had the name of the song and the artist, you had to pay for that.
Right.
Unlike the radio, you could turn on, you pay once to you pay once to get access to this medium, and then after that, you have a selection of a dozen or two dozen audio sources that hopefully will entertain you to some degree. So,
that dynamic has changed because, you know, you can have any music you want essentially in your pocket. You know,
exactly.
Back then, you know, you maybe you only had those 40 records at the local diner to listen to, and now that's a long case now.
But you said it. So you've explained exactly what the problem is for people who don't get it.
Oh yeah, no, I get it. I know what you're saying.
Back in the day, you had to pay for it because it was exclusive. You couldn't get it anywhere. Fast forward to when the Fraunhofer folks came out with that thing called MP3, and all of a sudden it could be found anywhere you'd like in that little device. Okay, what happened? It's no longer exclusive. So as one well-known famous program director said in one of his books, it wasn't important what the songs were. It was more important was between the songs that garnered the audience that they had, and that audience share made money for them, that program director, Rick Sklar.
Well, back before I got into engineering, I was a group program director, and that was always my rule. I mean, you know, the guy down the street's playing the same records. It's what we do in between the records that makes the difference, and that should be the situation today. That's not always the case, but that's the way it should be. And that's, you know, if radio is not doing that, then I'm along with everybody else who's talking about Pandora because they're right. We'll die. You know, I mean, all we are then is a jukebox plus a whole bunch of commercials. So if we don't have content that really sets us apart from Pandora, we're doomed. But I hope more than I think that we're starting to come around to that.
I hope you're right. I hope you're right. Think about the folks who are listening and watching to this netcast right now. they're listening and watching because they like what we're talking about. Some of them are left over from the previous show, Triangulation, on Leo's network. And I'm thinking about, I don't know about you guys, but I'll bet you, you and so many others who enjoy this podcast listen to other podcasts from the TWiT network, and maybe others too, like the TED Talks videos. I tend to watch those if I'm on the treadmill or doing something, flying in a plane where I can get some entertainment. I'll watch a TED Talks video before I'll watch a movie. I guess with a lot of local radio, especially jukebox-based local radio, I almost feel like I'm dumbing down by tuning into it. Do you ever get that feeling?
Oh, sure.
Yeah, that's possible. Sure. You have to remember, if you think of it in terms of psychology, the brain needs to be challenged, and you can challenge it visually. And when you challenge it visually, it's challenged differently than it is challenged when you do it auditory. That's a known fact. There's studies on it the whole bit. And radio has been the one medium that has been able to challenge the brain in such a way that it actually stirs activity and creates more. That's the best way to put it. I just read something about this recently in a neurology magazine. Whereas if you're visually watching something, depending on the actual visual item, it does not create a certain synapse to take place in the brain as an auditory excitement does. And that's, I think, one of the reasons why radio over the years or anything auditory has always had a little more, control or oomph. As the old saying goes, theater of the mind, picture, painting words with audio, painting pictures with words, that kind of thing. And there's some truth to it.
And
I think as broadcasters, we've lost sight of that because now all we're worried about is the quarterly reports. What are we going to make? Is the street going to be happy? And God knows if we don't do something, we're going to be dead meat. And the reality is you've already gone past the expectations of the financial success, but you just haven't seen it because you've decided just to ignore that and continue being greedy and losing sight of it.
And don't get me wrong. I mean, I would love to say that I don't think at all about, netcasting and Pandora's of the world. They're a fact of life and they're going to be a competitor for us till the end of time. However, where I tend to argue is when people say it's going to be the death of radio. And that's just not true. It is just not going to be the case. Is it kind of possible? Sure. But there's a lot of things that would have to happen in order to do that. In fact, as I like to say, we owe the cell phone companies right now a bouquet of flowers for unfortunately, this is a very unpopular position and I don't agree with it, but I'd like to thank them for putting caps on their data because it has certainly helped us as broadcasters. Okay. Personally, I hate it. I think it's a horrible idea. But as a broadcaster, hallelujah. That's great.
That's a whole great show subject altogether. Sometimes I'd like for us as engineers to get some numbers and discuss this because the fact is that over the air data, there's only room for so much of it. Even when you divide a city down into smaller and smaller cell sites, you still have a limited amount of bandwidth with which to transmit data. And every cell phone in the user in the world cannot be watching Netflix at the same time. It won't work. Not under the current model. Yeah. It'd be interesting for us to get some data and actually talk about that. Hey, guys, we got to take a quick pause here. Remind you, you are listening or watching to This Week in Radio Tech, episode number 123, with me, Kirk Harnack, along with Chris Tobin and Chris Tarr, our co-hosts on this episode. Want you to be sure you tune in a couple weeks. We'll be live at the NAB show in Las Vegas as the TWiT stage is put up there. Hey, our sponsor for this show is my employer, the folks at Telos, on the web at telos-systems.com. And I'm at the CBS radio facility at 345 Hudson Street in New York City, not too far from where they're building the new Freedom Tower. It looks really great going up. And I'm at the WCBS studios on the 11th floor. And here at the WCBS studios, they've got the Telos VX phone system. And they're really putting it to a lot of hard tests here at WCBS. They take a lot of phone calls and they do a lot of reporting. The reporters all have a Telos VX phone at their desk where they grab interviews and record them right off their software at their workstations. This right here, I'm holding up here in my hot little hands. This is a Telos VSET 12 phone and it's got access to 12 phone lines. It's a pretty cool device. I mean, hey, as engineers, you want me to tell you the truth about this thing? This is a Linux computer that looks like a phone, and software it's running, it's basically a soft phone. right? That's what it would be. I never really thought about this until one of our development engineers said, well, yeah, that's what's going on. I mean, it's not a dedicated phone device. Yeah, it's got dedicated buttons. I mean, this can't be a video game, right? Well, actually, it kind of could be. But anyway, it's running soft phone software. Well, that's kind of neat. And that just kind of proves how cool voice over IP and particularly the SIP protocol is for making a phone system that is flexible and useful. And we can just do all kinds of things in it, like multiple studios and multiple lines and easily sharing lines among studios. Hey, in the newsroom here, it's just a few yards from me. All of the reporters have one of these phones, and they all have access to all the normal on-air lines, plus a couple of their own lines that they can talk to Mayor Bloomberg or whoever's the newsmakers that day and get their interviews done. So, hey, if you're interested in getting a phone system for your radio station, you can connect a Telos VX system to existing phone lines like POTS or ISDN, PRI, T1 lines. You can do that through what's called a gateway device, which turns those lines into SIP, or you can bring SIP services directly into your facility, either over the public internet or by a private a connection, like maybe from XO Communications or others that provide private, dedicated bandwidth that's just for your phones. You can also share phones across a region, across the country, even spanning countries. You can make all your offices and your facilities seem like they're just right there together. That's how really cool SIP telephony is. So if you need a phone system for your place, I invite you to check out the Telos VX phone system on the web at telos-systems/VX. And tell them old Kurt Harnack sent you there. All right, we'll set that aside. That is so cool. By the way, you know, this phone just has an IP address. As far as the network is concerned, I'll push the menu button here, and I don't know if you can see that very well, but the menu pops up, and you can set up, give it an IP address, and tell it engine it's supposed to be looking at. Yeah, if you know anything about networking, you'll really understand SIP telephony really quickly. All right, guys, on the same vein we've been talking about here, getting new services into radio and trying to get make sure we keep some listeners amongst the threats, if you will. I guess to traditional radio broadcasters, they would be threats. But if you're on top of the ball in your radio broadcasting company, you're using these new technologies and getting things out through new ways, the internet, and maybe HD radio. And on this HD radio front, there's going to be an HD radio integrated smartphone that will be unveiled at NAB in a couple of weeks. Emmis Communications Senior Vice President and Chief Technology Officer Paul Brenner is telling Inside Indiana Business magazine that a prototype HD radio integrated smartphone will be introduced at the upcoming NAB show. Is this news? Will people want this? Will they demand it? Will it chew up batteries? Will people prefer this over listening to maybe other content that they download and store on their smartphone? Maybe it all depends a lot on how easy it is to get the content you want. You know, I was just thinking, I've got this HTC Sensation smartphone, and I never use this for listening to content because it's just, I don't know, it's just too complicated. Too much trouble to hit all the right buttons and get what I want. Whereas my iPod just seems so easy. I guess that was always Steve Jobs' dream to make it, you don't have to think about it to get the stuff you want to listen to. So, Chris, what do you think about HD radio in a smartphone? Is this a non-starter? Is this a great idea? What do you think?
I'm going to reserve judgment until I have a chance to see it. On the surface, it doesn't excite me too much. But like I said, it's real hard to tell whether I actually get my hands on one.
I would agree. Until I can see one, I can't say more than I'm not enamored with HD in general. And people I've talked to who do have HD radios have not said anything like, "Ooh, this has been great. It's changed my life," so to speak. So I'm not sure what to make of it. I still think radio stations need to be a little more aggressive and creative with their HD carriers. I think that's where we're still falling short. And, I've traveled around the country. I've heard a couple of things that actually were good, made sense, but they're on a micro scale. You know, it's a microcosm rather than a macro as far as what's been going on. And I think that needs to change. Otherwise, I mean, it sounds like a great idea. It sounds like it might be really good. But Chris is right. We got to see what it looks like, play with it, feel, see what the user experience is about.
I, you know, we keep talking about content. Here we are, engineers, you know, responsible for delivering the content, but not usually responsible for the content itself, unless we work at a really small station or if in a previous life, like Chris Tarr did, was a program director. For my own tastes, hey, wouldn't it be cool if, I have no idea if Leo would entertain such an idea, but wouldn't it be cool if in a lot of markets, I mean, if you were a broadcaster, you could pick up Leo's network and put it on an HD2 or HD3. Hey, I'd listen. Absolutely. What about some of these other music channels that are on the internet? And I think some public stations are doing what I'm going to describe here. On their HD2 or HD3, they're running Soma.fm or, you know, a Groove Salad. Or other such you know, all music that you're not going to find on other places on the radio. I'd tune into that. What if there was what if you really like progressive talk radio, but maybe the shows you want to hear, your favorite hosts, are not available in your market? But you know, you set them aside and put them on an HD2 or HD3. Would that be compelling enough to, you know, to listen? In my market where I live, Nashville, Tennessee, I happen to like the talk show host Neil Bortz. This is a mostly libertarian guy, and yet he's not on in the Nashville market. Oh, he's supposed to be on. It's, you know, Saturdays they play some best ofs. But if they put him on HD2, I'd make a little bit more effort to make sure there was HD working in my vehicles. So when I'm driving around, I might be able to tune in to Bortz. We're back to this content thing. I'm so frustrated that content that I think is compelling ain't on the radio. You guys want to whine about this a bit more?
Well, yeah, I was just saying, we're going to start calling the show Twerk. This Week in Radio Content.
Ah, yeah.
I agree. I think, though, it depends on the market. In my market here, we've got some pretty creative uses. We have a blues channel on one of ours, a simulcast of our AM station that has pretty bad nighttime coverage. We've got another station that is doing progressive talk on HD2, which is something we didn't have in the market before. Uh-huh. One station is doing audio from one of the TV stations. So I think, you know, it depends on the market you're in and the people who are in it, kind of dictate that.
Yeah, it's hard to say because I think a lot of folks, I know I've been involved with a couple of proposals for trying to do something with HD 2 and 3, and the response from the programming executives was really very myopic. And I've been to several programming seminars, both at NAB, RTNDA, RAB, and a few others over the last couple of years, because I do attend these non-engineering things to see how they impact my life. It was fascinating to watch and listen to a majority of folks who just didn't get that concept of something different. Chris is right, in probably places like where he is and other places that more in touch or in tune with the community because of its size, maybe because the ownership gets it. I'm not sure what to make of it because I have traveled to other markets that are not considered, say, the top 50 and have actually done something creative with the medium they have, and it works. But when you go to the larger scale, it's as if all of a sudden, well, we can't figure out why you'd want to do that. I mean, that was actually a statement I heard in one of the seminars. Why would you want to do that? And I was like, well, I don't know. It sounds like if you worked with the local colleges and did that event and covered it and gave them an opportunity to have an outlet on a major signal, they might just promote it within, which means you'd have new ears, new people talking. If you could reach the college crowd, that means you'd catch their mom and dad and other parents who actually, fall into that demo of 2554 that you've been trying to reach on that FM station that for some reason is a background music. It's just not getting anywhere. But me, that's just me thinking out of the box and looking at a different way to get it. Because I say that only because years and years ago, there was a top 40 disc jockey in Philadelphia. His name was Terry Young, known as the Motormouth. Fast talking, hot hits, top 40 station in Philadelphia. And people would ask him, how is it that you have an audience share in the 2554 and yet your program, which was on 7 to midnight, was more teens? All the events they hosted were teen-related. And his answer was, well, quite frankly, if I can reach the kids go to mom and dad and want to go to the events and want to participate. The mom and dad ask, where did you hear this? How do you know about this? And guess what? Back in the day of the diaries, they would write down, oh, yeah, my daughter listens to Terry Young, the Motormouth, WCAU 98 Now. And that station, his show, was successful in that level, and they just capitalized and cross. That was their idea of cross promoting, cross demos in 1984, 85, 86. So fast forward to today's technologies. If you took that same thinking, which doesn't exist in many places, you'd probably have a station just as powerful and exciting as what Chris has in his market at his stations.
You know, I think as engineers, we a lot of engineers have outlasted a number of program directors and general managers and so forth at various radio stations. That's not always the case, of course, but certainly some engineers have been around a long time. Doesn't mean their opinions are always right, but they sure have seen a lot come and go. And, you know, I realize also that, you know, reaching an engineer like us with your programming, okay, maybe we're not the target audience. Okay, maybe watching or listening to twit.tv is more what we're going to be doing, but not necessarily what my daughter or some other peers or other people my age are going to be doing. So certainly, you know, everybody's a programmer, right? We may think if they just do this, then more people would listen. They'd have something successful. But I do think as engineers, it is up to us to make sure that we understand and can explain and help implement as soon as ownership or programming wants to, more friction-free ways to get more diverse and interesting and compelling programming on the air. Hey, it's easy to take an old automation system and make it a jukebox for your HD2 or your HD3 station. But what if you could have a system where other people could contribute to it easily by, say, FTP or by other upload, that you had a private website where you had, like you were saying earlier, you had maybe some people who could produce programming at a university or college somewhere, or at a community center, or at a church, or a political group, and or community group, and they hey, guys, tell you what, how about every week you guys do a half-hour show? How about you do an interview show? How about Saturday afternoons, the HD3 is all yours? And we'll help you, because the technology to get all that done is so inexpensive now. It's darn near free. And so you could have a very compelling, almost pirate-like, almost like underground FM stations were back in the day. Would that be interesting to listeners? Because it certainly could be pretty easy to do from a technical and programming point of view. We're going to have to wrap it up pretty soon, but let me hear your reactions to that idea, that statement. But it's not a new idea. I think Chuck Kelly, one of our previous guests, he works at Nautel. He put together a community station up in Canada where he lives, and they had ways where other people could, you know, get programming in on the air. And I know this is not a new idea. We've had the people talk about it before. But it just seems to me, hey, that might be interesting to get this group or that group or the women's shelter or even this political group or that political group to put together some programming, get it on your air. And, you know, it doesn't have to run flawlessly. And with a little bit of help from somebody who knew what they were doing at the station about the automation system, it could run pretty well. I'll shut up. Chris Tarr, what do you think about that kind of notion, community programming?
Well, I think it's great. And I think that that's something, I don't know maybe if that's the model, but I do think that we're wasting HD space if we're not looking into that. I think that's really a great way to not only move HD radio forward, but also, you know, do something that we really should be doing, which is, you know, giving the community a true voice for, you know, to talk about things that are going on. So I think it's a great idea.
Absolutely. There's no reason not to. I attended the IBS convention recently here in New York City, the Intercollegiate Broadcasting System for non-comms, educational, and community radio, LPFMs and whatnot. And I talked to a few folks that their stations are working with some commercial broadcasters with some HD signals and doing along those lines. So there's a lot you can do. I think you have to be willing to accept the change. That's the key. If you can accept the change in the way the landscape is, it's not change in a negative way. It's a positive. Competition that we talked about, it's positive. You know, all these things actually are a good thing. And yes, we can sit here and say, you know, if programming only did X, Y, and Z, it'd be a better world. But the reality is, if you're a historian of any type, in order to be a historian, you have to observe the changes over time in the society that you're observing or whatever it is that you're historically recording. So many of us who have outlived, as Kirk, you pointed out, to program directors or many, many folks, DJs included, we are the historians that have had the opportunity to watch, observe, sort of, speculate on what would be better now knowing the past, where the future could go. And, you know, it's helpful. And if you understand that and apply technology, when you're talking to your general manager, your program director, sales manager, and they happen to say, by the way, do you think this would make sense? You could actually sit there and go, well, what you're trying to do makes sense. In order to execute it, we'd have to consider the following. And this is what the costs are involved. And now you've brought the technology editorial or the content together. And, you know, one, you've saved your position at the radio station. And two, you now add value to yourself and have a better chance of surviving changes down the road at that facility.
I will bet you that at this NAB show, we're going to see some more tools, maybe from the automation companies, to make this kind of, you know, contribution from several different people easier and maybe easier to manage at the radio station end. And if you're a program director and you've got, well, who am I to talk? I mean, I'm an engineer, right? I'm part owner of some radio stations. Here, I'm a good one to talk. We don't even have any HD on our stations. Wish it wasn't so expensive. Then we'd have some. But you're not making money on your HD channel now anyway. You probably haven't got that many listeners on it. Okay, maybe in New York City you do, but in plenty of markets you don't, especially if you're just making, you know, if you've just got the fourth country station in the market or the sixth, you know, classic rock station in the market, what are you really adding? I think it'd be very compelling to have interesting programming that was provided by a number of different content providers. Numbers, probably not going to be very big. I think there's opportunity for some compelling stuff here. Hey, high school basketball games in a market where you normally wouldn't have a channel where you would take the time to put those things on. Guys, we got to head out here. I mean, as usual, the engineers have all the programming and content answers, right? I'm sorry, was somebody about to punch in? Nope. Okay. Oh, sorry. Well, thought I heard a noise. And as usual, the engineers here have given their opinions. But I do think that it's our job to make sure that from a technical point of view, we understand or can understand how to do this stuff, how to help the owners of a station, the programs of a station, get compelling programming on the air. Hey, if you're getting programming from several different sources, you're going to have level problems. I mean, expect it. What are you going to do about it? How are you going to maybe auto-normalize a file that comes in every week from a church or a community group or a political group or the university or the drama club at the high school? How are you going to make sure that you can, without a great deal of trouble, bring audio files that come in up to some kind of standard so when they play back on the air, they're going to be okay? Think about things like that. Think about how you as an engineer might be able to contribute to the ease of putting together a radio channel. And then just maybe, you know, hey, talk to your programmers or your station owners about, we ought to do this, we ought to do that. We've got this AM that's darn near laying dormant over here. Let's get some programming on it and get practiced up at this and see if we can do something for our listeners, provide some kind of compelling programming that they may want to listen to. We're going to have to go, folks. We're going to need a show title. So, hey, after we close the show out, let's watch the chat room and see what we can come up with for a show title. I want to thank my co-hosts who have been so good on this show. First of all, Chris Tobin from Manhattan, New York, the best dressed engineer in radio. Thank you, Chris.
You're welcome, Kirk.
And Chris Tarr from Muckwonago, Wisconsin, still hasn't given us a SodaStream demonstration.
Sorry, one of these days.
Yeah, I want to see it, man. I want to see you use it before I buy one.
I think we could work something out.
Yeah. All right. Hey, thanks for joining us. Thank you for all your questions and comments in the chat room. There have been a lot of good ones, and I appreciate that very, very much. Be sure you tell your friends about the Twit Show. We're on every Wednesday at 8 p.m. Eastern Time on the twit.tv network. And you can, of course, subscribe to the show, download them, watch online, all that kind of stuff at twit.tv/twirt. And if you will go to Twitter right now and follow at twirtshow.com. At twirtshow. Man, brain fried. At twirtshow, you'll be notified when the show's about to start and a couple of compelling ideas throughout the week. So we appreciate you following. Thanks a lot. You guys take care. Thank you, Burke, for switching the show. And we'll see you next week on This Week in Radio Tech. Bye-bye.